Welcome to the ADH Deep Dive, the show that's not about ADHD, but is filled with proof it exists. My name is David J. Mund. I'm an actor, director, cinematographer, photographer, and host of the ADH Deep Dive. And this week, I'm joined by musician John Richard Paul. John and I first met in 2021 when we collaborated on a music video for John's song, Plus Two, the title track of John's first ever EP as a solo artist. In this episode, John and I talk about the awkward nature of social networking as an artist, the difficulties of creating art by yourself, and the unfortunate necessity of commodifying your passion. So thank you for joining me on this episode of the ADH Deep Dive. Let's dive in, shall we?
We are in the melt at the moment. Yeah, we got about probably about a foot and a half, almost 2 feet over the last couple weeks. And then we lost everything over the weekend. I would say by Friday, Saturday, it was all gone.
Did you have to cancel any shows during the intense weather? I did. I guess maybe let me interrupt you by answering my own question. You did a live show, right? Because one of them
was canceled. Yeah, that weekend, everything in town shut down. So they just didn't want anybody out on the roads. So all the shows got canceled, and Drew Hale's show was canceled as well. So we decided to do a kind of a joint live stream from our respective houses, which kind of provoked a little bit of PTSD in terms of bringing us right back to the thick of the COVID times,
right?
When no one was able to leave the house or do much of anything, and we were, you know, that was pretty much the only way in which we could perform.
Wild though that the inclination to go back to as it was during COVID is sort of that blessing in disguise. Zoom connections, the live performances, all that type of adapting in the moment. Mm-hmm. That's sort of I don't know if this is woo-woo, but not to get too holistic or whatever. I don't know the word I'm looking for, but that's humans' thing, right? We find ways to adapt quickly to environments and new strategies. And I wonder how things would be right now had COVID not happened and you get the weather shutdowns. Where was live performing online at the time? Were you doing anything before COVID, online?
No, it was more out of necessity. Just having so many, at that point I had been doing music full time for a little over a year. So my timing was just absolutely atrocious. But conversely, the job that I had prior to that was remote. And they decided to move my remote position from Traverse City to Pennsylvania, and let me go with a year's severance, which I took as the kick in the proverbial rear that I needed to make music a full-time venture. But it was just the irony of the situation was not lost on me when the entire company ended up having to go online and work remotely. And my position, which had been remote for about 4 or 5 years, was subsequently terminated 2 years before everybody started doing it.
And again, blessing in disguise though, right?
Very much
so. At the time, it's crippling. I was working at a bank and it was holy shit. Does this mean that all financial institutions are about to shut down across the world? Is that where we're at? And so, you get that traumatizing, we're going to have to let you go. We can't keep our doors open.
Right.
And then people slowly started getting hired back. And I was like, why am I not being hired back? What is happening? And you get in your head about it. And then you're I don't know if it's a sign, but it's there was incentive to take that severance. Obviously yours was right before COVID, but then during COVID there's a little bit of that as well. You're like, I have to make my own money, I have to do my own thing, so purely out of necessity I'm gonna work as hard as I can. And then when those opportunities for the 9-to-5 start popping up and you see open apply here or resumes, and you're like, man, I'm real broke, but I'm not going back to that. I can't do that.
Yeah, it's the whole idea of not having a plan B if you want your plan A to succeed. And that's really what I've adhered to. I mean, there's definitely been some lean times over the last few years, but I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, I've been my own boss now for over 4 years, and I'm able to do what I want when I want effectively, and build a business around myself and my skills instead of having to plug myself into an existing situation, which has been all the more satisfying and validating that I've been able to do it and make it a sustainable and a feasible career option here in Northern Michigan.
Right. And isn't it funny though, that like our drive was like, I'm going to work for myself so I can set my own schedule so I can do what I want when I want. And it's like, suddenly I think I'm working more than I ever have in my entire life. It's very hard to me for me to make any plans because I have no idea if I'm going to be working tomorrow or not.
Exactly.
So that uncertainty, that, or that certainty of scheduling ended up being the most uncertain thing about working for myself.
Right. Yeah, I had posted a meme recently that said something like something to the effect of, I'm going to quit my 9-to-5 to take on a 24/7 365, which is, you know, that's essentially what we're doing as being self-employed artists. We're never not working.
And the thing is, too, like as much validation comes from in the moment working, like obviously your work is performing, and we'll talk a lot about the music side of things in a little bit, but just using your art as your career can both give you the validation that you're looking for when it finally hits. But then when it's not working, that now means that if you're not getting these gigs, you're not getting income. For sure. Your art, the thing that you're most passionate about, is directly tied to your source of income. And so other than the creative stress, now there's financial stress on top of it. Right. But again, it's something we were striving for. It's like you don't know what you want till you got it, you know?
Yep. Well, and then you have the whole mental game therein where you start questioning the decision and am I following the right trajectory? Am I doing the right things? Am I talented enough? Am I good enough at what I'm doing? Is this even worth continuing to pursue simply because the work has dried up? I mean, this summer I think in July I played 34 shows, and obviously there aren't 34 days in July. Right. You know, in the last month, I think I played like 13. So going from, basically playing every day, sometimes multiple times a day, to going an entire week without working
is
not great.
Is that weather or music related?
It's certainly weather. I would say it's because of the seasonal nature of the business up here, in particular. I mean, the majority of what I do is with my duo partner Rhett Decor, as Rhett and John, and we play wineries, distilleries, breweries, all that kind of stuff. And a lot of that stuff is outside. And because we're in such a tourism based area. They don't have the income to be able to, or the revenue to be able to bring in music, in the off season, the way they are able to in the summer months. So a lot of the work is confined primarily to the weekends.
And you're not even my first Traverse City guest. So this is a familiar story as well.
Yeah.
It's that
very much so in this area.
It pops. And when it pops big.
Yes.
And then it just shrinks to like a tenth its size.
Yep.
And then you're kind of scraping. And then that kind of leads into traveling for you. You do a lot of traveling now musically. So maybe let's reframe. Well, actually, go ahead and say what you were going to say. And then
I was just going to say that since COVID, I haven't really done much traveling. I was traveling with Drew Hale a fair amount prior to COVID. But since then, I've kind of tapered that off I have a wife and two young kids, so I want to be able to be home. And, the money is good around here. As long as the work is available, I'm able to make a sustainable living. But it's just, this was the first true full year that I was able to see what it's like to be a full-time musician in Northern Michigan. There weren't any shutdowns or anything like that. So it's really forced me to reconsider how I approach the summer months when, I'm making the bulk of my income. I really need to sock that away as much as I can, to then be able to carry through to these leaner months.
So when I've seen you down in my area, like what is the one factor, like what is the decision making, or what is the process that goes into making the decision whether or not it's worth it to travel to a show? Is it literally just like, is the money going to be worth it? Or is it like you want to hit target demographics, or you know?
Well, it's when I do my solo stuff at this point, I don't really do it for the money. I do it just to be able to play my songs and get them in front of other people. I kind of approach it the way I used to approach when I had a full-time job. That would be, you know, that's my day gig, that's where the bulk of my income comes from, and that it allows me to be able to go and play music, you know, with Drew or whoever else I was playing with at the time. And now it's kind of like Rhett and John is the bulk of my income. And that's kind of my day job. And, you know, it's a very satisfying day job, but it allows me to then go off and play solo shows where I'm not really expecting to make any money. It's more for the artistic satisfaction of being able to play to an appreciative audience.
Let's break those projects down then. Just sure. Obviously we have somewhat of an uninformed audience. Mm-hmm. Your name off the bat, obviously I've introduced you in the intro by now, but your stage name, John Richard Paul, first, middle, last.
Yes. All three names as Jack Smith likes to call me.
All three first names.
Yep.
All three names.
Straight up serial killer.
Oh gosh. You're just one step away from a Wayne Gacy.
Well, it's either serial killer or Americana artist. That's really the only reason to use all three names. So I went with Americana artist, obviously. So now, did the full three names.
Have you hit the sweet spot of both?
No.
Oh, no. So you're not both a serial killer and
No, I'm not. I'm not intelligent or savvy enough or I guess that makes me sound a little. Little suspect. No.
I was just gonna say you're not. No, me,
what are you talking about? Of course not.
But
it's a silly question. Why would I admit that on this?
Right. Yeah. Of course. That's your solo. That's you. That is the more recent project. You are also part of a couple other musical projects as well. And I guess maybe I don't need to introduce them. Why don't you go ahead and sell them yourself?
Sure. The solo project really was born of COVID and lockdown and just needing an extra outlet, creatively. I would say that, I started writing considerably more than I had in more than a decade, when everything shut down, just because I was looking for things to do and trying to keep my mind occupied. I was reading a lot, but you know, obviously you can't leave the house. I remember there was a 3-week stretch where I didn't leave the house or the neighborhood. And then when I finally did, how surreal it was to go out into the world again.
Yeah.
But prior to the shutdown, I'd been playing with Rhett and John, which was kind of the that was a project that was born out of my having lost my corporate gig. You know, I've been a bass player for folks for about a little over 20 years at that point. I'd been playing with Drew Hale for quite a while, and then a lot of different artists in town.
How long is quite a while, by the way? Because I wasn't familiar. I met him through you.
Yeah, I've been playing with Drew since September of 16. So 6 years this year.
Did you guys meet each other in the music scene?
Yeah, I had been playing in a group called Tuesday Radio that was playing covers at a place called Kilkenny's here in town. Mm-hmm. And Drew would come down every once in a while. He was friends with our vocalist, John Pomeroy. And he would sit in with us. And I had always said, you know, if you ever put a band together or anything like that, just please keep me in mind. Was kind of my standard line to just about anybody because I was wanting to play with as many people as possible. Because I moved back to town from Chicago in 2007. And I went about probably 5 years or so where I didn't play music at all. And then around 2010 or so, got back into it. And then just started playing with a bunch of different people in town. I think at one point I had played with about 15 or 16 different acts in town.
All right.
Throughout the course of the year. So my goal was to work to be kind of a first call bassist in town. But that, again, that was when I still had a corporate gig and wasn't too worried about the income. Once that went away, then I had to change gears, and switched over to acoustic guitar and started working on covers with Rhett and just kind of coming up with our own take on well-known songs. We kind of have positioned ourselves as kind of an oldies radio station, and that's basically the least offensive thing you could put on in an office environment. You know,
it's true.
People will be okay with what you're playing. You know, we're not in that way too, we're not having to stick with trends or be current or anything like that. And it's songs that we like, and it targets the demographic that we were aiming for as well. Kind of that boomer generation, that you know, frequents the wineries and breweries and things like that. And frankly, I mean, to not put too fine a point on it, they're the ones with money too.
So, I was just going to say, they are the ones that are willing to go out and spend the money.
Exactly. So it's like, you know, this is, I, from the start, I've approached it as a business, and it's, you have to, I mean, you can have any sort of artistic ambitions you'd like, but at the end of the day, it is a business, and you need to focus on making money if you want it to be sustainable.
I know you're speaking in general about your life and to a general audience, but you are talking directly to me in that, like, I don't know, man, there's some weird, I don't know if it's shame or guilt or just unease about selling my art as a business when strictly, like, that's what I have to do. I literally have to do that. And so, like, the easiest way to, like, just assume that I'm going to be able to do that is as a cinematographer. And, you know, I can shoot weddings or music videos or whatever. But, like...
Which you do very well, speaking from experience.
Hey, thanks, buddy. Which is kind of... Let's... You know what? Let's... Screw this little rant I was going to go on. Let's talk about how we met. Which was through both of us trying to treat our art like a business.
Yeah.
I think... Did I hashtag target you or something? Did I reach out to you and say, like, I heard your music?
Yeah, you had reached out via Instagram.
Yeah, I probably was like, when I first got the camera, which is the one that I'm still using right now, haven't changed anything. That is to my chagrin, just to be clear. That is not, or chagrin to my dismay. What's the word I'm looking for? I'm not happy about it. We're super clear. I was like, I want to find some music video or artists who want to do music videos. And so I started in this, I don't want to like call anybody out in particular, so I'm not going to shame anybody, but I ended up pigeonholing myself into the Up North white boy rap group, or the rap scene. And I was kind of stuck there for a little bit. And I was like, I want to find some acoustic artists or just solo artists who actually play an instrument. not that I have any problem with rap or rap adjacent music. I just, it's not what I wanted music video wise.
Right.
And so I think I just looked up hashtag Traverse City artist, Traverse City music or something, and just scrolled Instagram until I found an artist that sounded good. And then, you know, you put the little feelers out, and then I guess at that point, where were you at in your career when you had made the decision to be like, okay, I'll let this random stranger dude who hit me up on Instagram shoot a music video for me?
It was fairly early on. I mean, it was
2020.
Was it 20 or 21?
I thought it was 2020 because it was the first year. I think it was like, was it 21?
I think it was 21 because we shot the video at the end of June of 21.
That's right.
And I think you had reached out in March or April or something, and we had done a, you know, FaceTime call or something like that and kind of gotten a feel for each other. But, you know, with this whole thing, I've just kind of approached it as everything is kind of happening for a reason, and certain people come along for certain reasons. I mean, yourself, I played a show at a place in Elk Rapids over St. Patrick's Day weekend, which anybody who's heard my music knows it is not conducive to a St. Patrick's Day crowd. But I was booked.
It's a little slow for some wasted Irishman.
Yeah, I was booked that weekend anyway. They knew what they were getting into, but I haven't played there since. Mostly just out of my own shame and not wanting to reach out to be rejected and told, hey, it's not going to work. So it's a self-preservation tactic. But in any case, there was one gentleman sitting at the bar, and the entire place was packed, but nobody was listening. He was the only one who was listening, and he was, you know, zeroing in on me the entire time. And he approached me on set break and said, hey, I play pedal steel and a bunch of utility instruments if you're ever looking for somebody. And I, you know, we exchanged contact information. And then when I started working on the record I'm working on right now, I was like, you know what? I feel like he came along for a reason. He was at that show. I'd never heard him play. I had him come in, play on the record. He played on, I think, four or five tunes, and he nailed it, knocked it out of the park right away. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna stick with that kind of intuition, gut feeling. Everything happens for a reason. Same with yourself. I mean, it's like this guy is interested. He wants to try and do something together. Let's see what happens.
Well, I think one of the hardest things in our fields too is taking someone at face value when they say they like what you do.
Right.
Because like, yes, like a full honesty, like I was/am a broke cinematographer. So I was like, I want to reach out to as many people as I can.
Right.
But I was selective in the people that I reached out to because I was tired of working with artists that I didn't think actually sounded good. Right. But on the flip side, if somebody reaches out to me, they're like, I want to work with you or blah, blah, blah. My first intuition is like, you're doing this for yourself.
Right. Exactly.
Like, you don't need or want me. Maybe that's, you know, my inherent daddy issues. I don't know. But it could also be just the curse of the artist that like, you know, you gotta maybe trust sometimes that like you are either worth the time or that this is a good investment in yourself to collaborate with someone.
Right. Well, and again, I think that goes back to just trusting that gut instinct. When you get a sense of a person, and you know, when we talked, for, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes, something like that. And you know, I felt like I had a pretty good sense of who you were, and what your intentions were. And it seemed like a good fit. And I'm still here. So
when it comes to the flip side, like when you're making your own stuff, there is a sense of ownership in collaboration. So like, you know, for example, the band that I'm in now, like they've been around for 10, 15 years, have a whole history that exists before me.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I am a part of it, there's like a sense of ownership. And if I were the one that was in it for 10, 15 years, let's say this is your career in particular, and this person reaches out to you and they want to be on your album or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever like put your guard up in that, like, you know, I'm only going to work with this particular caliber of person, or like, how do I want to word this? Is it like,
I think for me personally, having been a bassist for so long, you know, I'm already inhabiting a collaborative role. So had I started as a solo artist and then started working with other people, it would have been a little bit different feel. But because of the fact that I've effectively been a sideman for 20 plus years.
Bassists don't get the love they deserve, man. Okay, I see you for who you are.
Thank you. I feel like that kind of shaped my approach to the collaborative process. Sure, it's been weird, you know, working with other people on stuff that is, to me, very personal. Mm-hmm. Kind of lost my train of thought there where I was going with that. Apologize.
You're good.
So what were we talking about here?
The collaborative process. People kind of having ownership in your projects.
Well, and I would say, and this is not to sound, you know, egocentric or full of myself, my producer buddy, Philip Parker, and I have kind of been joking that I need to work on developing some latent narcissism to be an effective solo artist. So I'm going to tap into that a little bit and say that I've kind of proven myself as a musician here in town and been able to play with a higher caliber of artists. And then in turn, I've been able to draw on that and bring folks in to play on my record. Specifically, you know, Drew is obviously on it and he crushed it. I have, Andrew Dost from Fun, is on the record.
What?
Phil Parker, who,
hold on. Like Fun, like We Are Young Fun.
Yeah. He lives just down the road from me.
Andrew Dost is the singer, right?
He was one of the multi instrumentalists.
I'm trying to remember. Wait.
The tall guy.
I think it's very, yes, because I met him. I was an intern at the Interlochen Arts Academy, and I was doing like photo and video work for all the master classes. Yeah. And he came in and did a master class and told a big story about how they played with Queen and like, what? Yeah. Oh man, look at you go. I didn't even know that.
He teaches there now. He teaches at Interlochen.
No kidding.
Yeah, no, he's a real nice guy. I met him through another buddy in town, Andrew Lutz, who he and I had played together in bands in college, and I think going back about 25 years or so, all the way to high school. In fact, we played in a band called Dreamcoat, and then we were in a band called The Farewell Drive, and then The Stationary Set. And then that band moved to New York, and I elected to stay behind. But then Andrew and his wife moved to town, I think I want to say about 6-7 years ago now. And we've been trying to get him to play music ever since. He had basically renounced it and didn't want to have anything to do with it. But he's back doing it now. And so we were working on an album for him. But then he and his wife decided to have twin boys.
How dare they? Who does that?
So we were working on pre-production for his album, and I got to know Andrew Doss through that, because he was working as kind of a producer and playing keys on the record, and I went back into my role as bass player for that. And that's how I met Phil Parker as well, who was for a number of years was the cellist for Gregory Allen Isakoff. Which is funny because he was friends with my brother growing up, and he told me that the first bass he ever touched was mine back in the mid-90s, and which, you know, was great, but I wanted to know what he and my brother were doing in my room touching my shit.
Yeah, true.
But they didn't have an answer for that. So.
You think that you make a career out of making music, and you think that everything's forgiven, right? No, it was still wrong. Right. You don't get to go in my room.
You don't do that. I've been telling my boys, you don't touch other people's instruments without asking permission.
That's true.
Come on.
You know, we can jest about it, obviously, but like, that is true. There is a very sacred nature to some people.
Some people are very, very particular about these things. So yeah, I'm trying to instill in them from a young age that you do not touch anybody's instrument without their explicit permission first.
Yes. There's a philosophy in the video world as well, that like, there needs to be an announced, like you need to announce it when you have it in your possession. Like if I'm handing the camera off to you, like you have to verbalize, got it. And like, mm-hmm. I have to verbalize letting go, like just right. because you're right. so particular about the, I mean, it's multi-thousand dollar instruments or pieces of equipment.
For sure.
Like, for you don't want to play around with that kind of stuff.
No.
So, on the note of, like being in multiple projects, one of the things that I found when I was first getting into just trying to explore any type of solo musical career is that like if I write a riff, I have a hard time deciding where that goes. Like, mm-hmm. like does that go for my project? Does that go for this project that I'm doing over here? How do you end up deciphering those? Or do you not really run into that because you're like...
Yeah, I don't really run into it because of the fact that I've kind of set out to have these kind of disparate parts of my creative self, mm-hmm. where, you know, the solo stuff is firmly rooted in the singer-songwriter Americana tradition. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's to me, a great song can be just voice and guitar, or even just voice. You don't need to have all the extra stuff, you know, as long as the bones are strong, you can build on it however you want. So for me, from a writing standpoint, I'm trying to write songs that can be properly conveyed just through voice and guitar. And then with Rhett and John, it's all, like I said, it's all covers, but we're doing them, you know, in ways, that almost feel like originals, because of the way we approach the arrangements. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's really, you know, it's just the two of us. And more often than not, it's just me playing guitar. So I'm trying to flesh out the arrangements as much as humanly possible, with, you know, with a lead line, a rhythm line, a percussion line, bass line, and all that stuff. And I'm not doing any looping or anything like that. So it's all live and in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'd use a lot of jazz chords and things like that, and try and incorporate bass lines into what I'm playing.
One of the things I have to imagine, I know some of the order here, but if you had to rank your confidence between the five being bass, guitar, singing, writing, and performing, like mm-hmm. where would you kind of rank those? I mean, I imagine bass is at the top, but then from
bass is at the top. I would say performing is second.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's almost like a split personality. Like in daily life, I'm very reserved and, you know, definitely introverted. And this is probably the most people will ever hear me talk.
Drawing it out of you.
I'm generally not comfortable in majority of situations. And I think that kind of hurts me a little bit because I probably come off as being aloof when really it's just massive anxiety. Hmm. When I'm on stage, I don't even think about it. I'd never feel more comfortable than when I'm on stage. It's like, it's a completely different thing. And it always has been. Like even when I was playing in college, I'd be quiet and reserved the rest of the time. And then on stage, I'd be thrashing around and screaming and all this other stuff. And it's just like, it's a cathartic thing for me really more than anything. And it's the only place I feel really comfortable and confident in myself is when I'm on stage. And it's been interesting to go from playing in a band where you're surrounded by a bunch of different people and getting used to that. And then going down to just playing with the two of us where, you know, you're extremely exposed. That was the confidence kind of came down a little bit on that. And then to then go to just solo I could never see myself playing as a solo artist.
Could you see yourself writing as a solo artist?
I had done a little bit in college and a little bit after. And I've always been writing really shitty songs all along. But I feel like I've kind of hit my stride and found something that works for me creatively. So I would say, getting back to the ranking, I would say guitar is probably third. I would say writing is probably fifth, because I don't feel like I'm a very strong writer. I feel like I've developed a voice over the last couple of years, that I feel comfortable in and I'm able to write in. I'm unfortunately not one of those ones who can write, just sit down and write. I have, you know, Drew is obviously like that, friend Kyle Rashi, who can do that as well. Well, you met Kyle
at
The Stray when we played, back in October. Mm-hmm. I mean, those guys could just sit down and churn out songs like nobody's business. And for me, I can't really get into a character or anything like that. I'm always writing from my own viewpoint, I guess, if that makes sense.
I think, sorry, just to hone in on that. Do you mean, sure, when you're saying writing, do you mean like lyrically the stories behind it or the song structure? Yep. Okay.
Yeah, lyrically. Yeah, I think like musically that all kind of sorts itself out. And I think I'm more or less proficient enough in my understanding of how songs are put together, which has been another nice thing, not to go off on another tangent, but it's been another nice thing about playing with Rhett and John is taking these classic songs that have stood the test of time effectively. A lot of the stuff we're playing is over half a century old at this point. Mm-hmm. And breaking those down to their base elements and seeing what makes them successful and makes them something that really sticks with people, either melodically, lyrically, structurally, breaking that down to the base elements and then reconstructing it in our own way. Has really helped me immensely in my songwriting, and being able to kind of get into the guts of things, the workings of how songs are put together.
There's a few times so far that I've accidentally almost gotten into a deep depth conversation about music theory. So we'll try to avoid the rabbit hole that can be. But I imagine, just being someone who is proficient musically and has the capacity to write, you know that, like, I'm not going to say it's a meme, but it's like there's a typical chord structure that, like, if you think of all major like pop like sensations, like it's the same chord progression, right? Like,
sure.
Do you find when you go into your own writing that, like, you have to start the algorithm as it usually does? Like, there's like a way that you sit down and write, or did the things come to you more often? I know that's kind of like a vague question for artists, like, but like, do you give yourself a structure?
Yes and no. I mean, I think because of the genre that I am working in right now, I mean, there are, I don't want to say parameters necessarily, but there are definitely, set chord progressions. I mean, the 1-4-5 is pretty much pretty standard. And I would say that, you know, the bulk of my songs are 1-4-5, but then the challenge becomes finding new and interesting ways to kind of rework the 1-4-5, both chordally and melodically. So that it doesn't feel like it's the same thing over and over again. I mean, that's a lot of that is what the capo is for. But it's trying to find ways to use the same basic musical ideas in new and different ways. And I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily succeeding at that, but I've definitely grown more confident in using that kind of template in exploring it. For all it's worth. But then lately I've been trying to expand more and into more, I don't want to say complex chord progressions, but well beyond the three chords and the truth.
You can toot that horn, man. I was going to say, as someone who I am relatively okay at most of your basic onstage instruments. I can do bass, I can play guitar, I can drum, I can sing, I can do, you know, it's the jack of all trades, but master of none. But objectively, watching you on stage, just over the course of the last, year and a half, I guess, that we've known each other, like, I can see a little bit, maybe, I don't know if this is just in confidence, but in the few times that I've seen you, musically, the way that you are structuring things, it seems like you are approaching, whether it's your licks or what have you, just more confidently. So, you know, I sense some timidness and you're like, well, I'm trying to like do things a little bit differently. Like you can sense on stage.
Yeah. I've made a conscious effort to just settle into the role. I mean, I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And so there's no reason to continuously second guess myself on stage, at least, you know, I can do that all day long when I'm at home, and I do. But when I'm performing, it's, you know, regardless of how many people are there, I'm going to give it my all. It's what I do. If I'm going to call myself a professional, I need to act like it, you know, and perform consistently. A lot of it is, you know, just that, growth in confidence.
Yeah.
Both as a performer and as a vocalist and as a songwriter, as a guitarist. I mean, prior to losing my job, I didn't really play guitar at all. This was kind of born out of necessity. I mean, I still consider myself a bass player, and I kind of awkwardly.
Yeah, but you play that.
Folks know that I'm a bass player, not a guitar player.
You play that bass like a guitar, though. Like, you can freaking shred that thing. I have never seen, like, I've seen people online, but I don't know a bass player that can throw down as well as you. Okay. Well,
thank you. I appreciate it.
I don't know what your capacity is for accepting compliments.
It's very, very low.
Just as uncomfortable as I am. Okay. I was gonna say.
Yes. Yes.
But,
yes, you can see my face changing.
Yes.
Changing color.
Yeah. I'm going to have to go through and color correct my own face every time I get compliments. Mm-hmm. And just like you're doing, anytime I'm like, oh, thanks. I can't say anything. I take a drink or I reach for one of my vices.
Let's find another way to, reframe the conversation and move away from talking about
okay I can do that
be in any capacity
yeah so well,
let's talk I, about you
well I've done enough of that but I can't we can pick up on a Venn diagram of where our arts collide a little bit. I think for anybody in the creative field this applies, whether it's writers or performers, musicians, actors, whatever. You kind of do what you know, right? Like you write to what you know, if you're writing a script or you're writing a song. An outside observation is that a lot of, at least this past EP, was it an EP or full album? The Plus Two.
The plus two was an EP. It was just three songs.
So at least a lot of that, or just what you're doing on stage, a lot of it has to do with your family, a lot of like stories from your past. I'm not taking anything away from what the stories are. I just know that inherently, like when you first get into a new field, you specifically target towards what you know. But I think the way that you write about family lends itself to being more palatable for a general audience as well. Because like we said, like, you know, you go to these wineries or whatever, you go to these coffee shops, there's a lot of boomers in there. A lot of old folks who are just willing to sit down and listen to good music. But that doesn't mean objectively the music that's there isn't good music for a wider audience. It just happens to be something that older folks can relate to or whatever. Or when you go towards making music, are you searching for a target audience? Like, are you looking to relate to specific people? Like, you know, I put these shout outs or this podcast, I say it's towards creatives. Like, do you have a target demographic, or is it quite literally anybody that can hear me? I'd love to hear me.
No, you know, with my own stuff, I mean, this is going to sound pretentious, but I write for myself. And the fact that, you know, by writing so personally, it subsequently taps into universal themes. Mm-hmm. It then becomes relatable because of the fact that it's honest.
Yeah,
I guess. I mean, that's what I've heard feedback wise from folks, is that there's an honesty and authenticity to what I'm doing that resonates and comes through in the songs. And that's the highest compliment I could get, because of the fact that I am writing so personally, but then to have it resonate on a universal level, and have themes that other folks can relate to without, you know, having necessarily specifically gone through the same things that I have, is, that's the whole idea with art, is being able to connect with other people. Mm-hmm. And then to be able to do that successfully is immensely gratifying.
As a father, because clearly I'm coming at this, there is, you know, the joke of it, but like, if you don't have kids, I'm sure you could never truly empathize what it's like to be a parent. What are some of the, like, and I guess we can dance carefully around this so as not to, like, you know, talk too much about your home life or your family life, but like, there is the obvious stress of being a parent and trying to make a career out of your art. I know that a lot of parents take the moment that they become a parent and say, well, now it's time to stop.
It's time to get serious and grow up.
Right, right. There's a clearly separate path there. The fork in the road is, now it's time to get serious and grow up, or now it's time to take this new role and use it as incentive to get better at what I do. And I think, again, viewing from the outside, the authenticity behind that is, instead of, like, as an artist, you can say, well, instead of saying, well, I had kids, now I have to give up on my art, now your kids are part of your art.
Yeah, very much so.
How does that, you know, as sappy as you'd like to be, how does parenthood influence your career as a performer, not just a musician?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to the fact that when both my boys were born, I was still working in a corporate environment. So I had the financial stability of and safety net of knowing that there would be a paycheck every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Losing the job then forced me to, you know, work exponentially harder at what I'm doing now, so that it wouldn't become an issue. I mean, basically at this point, I measure success as being able to continue to pay my bills, feed my kids, keep a roof over our heads, which I've managed to do more or less. I mean, it's been, like I said, a little tight here and there. But the fact that I'm continuing to be able to do it, doing something that I love and I'm passionate about, I hope that then sets a good example for them to be able to do, you know, take seriously what you want to do and put in the time and effort needed to be successful at it. But that you don't have to follow necessarily a preset path, in terms of career. And then, I mean, for me, I was a journalism major in college. So I think that kind of plays into the style of writing I do, and that I draw from my own life, in my writing. I've never been able to write, from a a fictional standpoint, I guess. I've attempted to here and there, but it's just, it never, it rings of inauthenticness. And I just, I'm sticking with what I've been doing because it's what makes the most sense to me right now. And is what's, I don't want to say the easiest to write because I don't think anything is necessarily easy. And in terms of writing, like I said, I can't sit down necessarily and just write. It has to be, it's almost like I'm constantly shifting through some giant cosmic radio station, and then eventually something comes in and I get it just long enough to be able to put it down, and write it. And then, you know, thematically it's, I'm considering where things are, you know, something that might've happened, that day with the boys or with my wife, and then trying to process that and explore the idea behind it. I don't know if that answers your question.
It's not necessarily even a question, just a part of conversations that for me, this is the segment of the podcast where I start to project. For me, it's significantly different in that, like, anytime, and I mean this musically and just creatively in general, if I have a story that is not true, I love to tell that story. Like, it's fun to perform something that isn't true. But the moment that the vulnerability comes out, when I'm like, this is me, I'm being raw, I'm being honest, that's where I feel the most intimidated, where I'm like, people don't want to hear this. Like, I'm not interesting. Like, my story isn't anything unique. So when I get the most raw, that's when I feel the most fake.
Yeah.
Do you think that there, do you have any insight into why that may be, not just for me in particular, but like why you feel more comfortable writing about you than it is writing about just some fake story?
Well, I think it's just not necessarily being comfortable in my own skin, but knowing myself. And, you know, I think for you specifically, having a background in acting in that, and you have, you know, a certain level of comfort in inhabiting roles or characters or anything like that. And that just, that makes me so uncomfortable to even consider. I took one acting class in high school and it was terrible. And then I was in one play and I had one line, and it was, what was the line? I understand you had two sons, Mrs. Antrobus, Cain and Abel from Skin of Our Teeth. that was the only line I had, and I managed to memorize it. And
you've held on to that for what, 30 years now? 37 years?
Hey.
Oh, sorry, are we not calling you?
Not that long. No, that would have been, I think, 99 I did that. So 23 years.
Bro, that's not. Listen, I know that I am, whatever, a chunk of change younger than you. However, anything pre-2000s still to me is like, or, you know, early 2000s, it still feels close. Like, it doesn't feel that far away, but to think oh, wow, that was decades ago.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it was, I was visiting my folks over the Thanksgiving holiday and, you know, watching the football games and realizing that the majority of the players on the Michigan team weren't even born when I was in college. Dude.
That one's weird. Like knowing that every single college athlete is younger than me. There's a good amount of professional athletes that are younger than me. And at a certain point, like, you know, mid 30s is when, like, they say that some of those professional athletes are at their peak. It's like, I'm around the age of people at their, like, physical peak fitness.
Right.
And I'm like, we just live totally different lives now. It's just a totally, I don't know. It's just watching football in general. I feel old. But okay. So no more sports. Get that out of here. Ah, gross.
Sorry. I was kidding. it wasn't my intent. It was just,
how dare you. So again, another segment of projection here. How many things do you sit on that will never see the light of day? Like, or are you just like, I wrote this, I got to get it out?
I mean, there's a whole hard drive full of songs that I wrote prior to being much more serious about it that are just god awful that no one will ever hear.
Are they objectively god awful or?
Yes. Yes. Hmm. Yes. They are terrible. There have been a couple that I've been able to kind of rework and revamp and feel comfortable enough playing. But really, for me, it's if I don't feel like a song is working or I don't feel like it's coming together the way I want it to, I just abandon it. Hmm. So I have a lot of fragments that I'll never do anything with. I don't like to come back to things. I've never been one for editing.
Interesting.
So I feel like it's more a genuine representation of what I was trying to convey in that given moment, if I'm able to capture it all at once. So I would say if I haven't been able to put a song together in about a half hour to an hour, I just let it go. I don't think it's worth pursuing.
That's so fascinating to me because my life is built on repurposing old shit. Like old ideas or old note cards that are sitting up on my wall or whatever, just little notes that are written and filed away. That is the only way I'm able to make stuff. I give up on just about every project I'm working on at about the 80% mark. Cause I'm like,
yeah,
can't finish it. This sucks. Yeah. Objectively, I would be able to have an ending by now or whatever. So a perfect example, the song for this podcast, the intro music, is a riff that I made in GarageBand 4 years ago because I was trying to structure some sort of song. I couldn't think of any lyrics, or the lyrics that I wrote were too on the nose or whatever. I ditched it, but I never got rid of the file. Then when I was making the podcast or conceptualizing the podcast, I was like looking through Soundstripe or some of those royalty-free music softwares or programs, and I was like, I can't find anything that works. Let's look through my archives and see if I can make my own stuff. And then I immediately found that. I was like, this actually fits pretty well for what I'm trying to go for. So I say that all to say that, like, I feel you on reaching a point in your project where you just have to throw it away. You're like, I'm done with this. But I don't know if it's OCD or what, my stubbornness, I can't help but go back to things to be like, no, I know there's something there.
Yeah.
Do you ever re-explore your music in that way?
I'll give it a listen every once in a while, but I won't try and expand it or anything like that. I don't like going back to things. I like just kind of moving forward, and I think that's why doing a record has been both rewarding and frustrating, in that I've had to live with this music now. We've been working on the record since April. It's about 75-80% there, but I'm so sick of it at this point. I'm proud of what we've accomplished and how it sounds and everything, but I'm just, at the same time, I don't even want to have to think about it anymore.
Interesting.
I'm ready to move on to the next thing. I think because of the fact that when I was recording music previously, I would do it myself for myself. I would spend an afternoon just working on an idea and build it, and then that would be the end of it. You know, this was pre social media and all that, so I wasn't trying to create content the way I am now. I mean, before we even started this, I did videos of like 6 or 7 of my songs that I haven't posted yet, just to have something and then put it out.
And the thing that you said, shared on your Instagram story.
Yeah,
I shared it, boy.
I saw that. Thank you.
Okay, okay, okay. Just want to make sure that
follow, share. Richard Paul music.
Yeah. Oh, there's a time for plugs, man. Okay, you wait till the end. You have to work your full shift before you clock out. Okay.
You have to be constantly on and promoting things.
I know.
As a self-employed artist. So yeah, it's. I mean, it's just. If I'm not feeling good about how a song has come together or turned out, I won't post it. I would say the majority of what I posted prior to today has been, I wrote the song and then within 15 minutes I post it online. I don't know. I guess I'm looking for that instant gratification.
Yes.
And validation.
Okay.
Of what I'm doing. And it's just like, you know, that's not a healthy way to go.
No,
about doing it.
But God damn, if I can't help doing it myself. Like, I take a picture of something, or I shoot a video or whatever. I post one of these teasers. Like, I almost did it with the episode that got posted today is actually, in my opinion, one of the more authentically honest and raw conversations that I've had with someone on the podcast. We talked a lot about self-image and body dysmorphia and eating disorders in particular. And I was so excited for people to see it that after I had shot and edited the episode, I was just like, let's whip up a teaser real fast. And I whip up the teaser together, and then I send it to the person who's in the episode, Emily Miller. Let's give her the shout out that she deserves. Saw that like the teaser was so lazily thrown together that the stories that I had put in the teaser didn't supply any context. It was just like little sound bites or whatever. But because I don't have anybody to check me, to check my work, I do fall into that trap of like, once I think it's ready, I'm posting it. I'm going to get this word right. Chagrin is not the word I'm using here. Is that correct? To my chagrin? Much to my chagrin?
You might want to use to your detriment.
Since I probably just lost 4 to 5 minutes worth of footage, let me sum up this little mini rant by saying I put a lot of shit out there, a lot of garbage content, because it's not checked, not cleared. I'm not collaborating with anybody. It's just myself. Is that a superpower or is that a curse to have for you? In that, like, you don't have to like put it through any check marks. You don't have to have anybody vet it before you put it out. But that could mean that you put something bad out there that you just needed a second pair of eyes or ears on.
Yeah, no, I think there, and I think the flip side to that is that, you know, you either get that instant validation that you're seeking, or if there's nothing, no traction on it, you just get that crippling anxiety and depression. And we've talked before, imposter syndrome. And you just feel like, what am I doing? I'm wasting my time doing this, which is a completely backwards way of approaching this. I mean, just think of the generations prior to ours who were doing the exact same thing that we're doing. They're able to work on things and build their, you know, creative catalog, not necessarily in a vacuum, but we're able to work on it in a safe space and then be able to present it to the world. Whereas we're constantly seeking validation at all hours of the day. You know, we're at this point working on this album is kind of like, what is the point of putting out music in 2022 or 2023, as the case may be, when everybody and their brother is doing that? It's a constant barrage of white noise. And unless you have a bunch of money behind it, it's just going to go off into the vacuum. Like, what is the point of doing this? Are we doing this for ourselves, for some sort of posterity, some sort of immortality? It just the need to be creative and put something out into the world to simply say that we are an artist. Are we looking for some sort of financial validation, some sort of commercial validation, creative validation? What is it we're looking for?
Well, first of all, if I was looking for financial validation, I would have given up a long time ago.
Yes.
Let's just be super clear there. But second, again, I think this is a multi-track answer in that, like, there are, well, I guess it's subjective, first of all. The validation that you're seeking really is just, you know, dependent on the trauma that you had growing up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, obviously there is an inherent need for attention when it comes to the performers, or a desire for intention, not a need. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be rooted in vanity. It just has something to do with, we enjoy getting laughs or smiles out of other people. It doesn't necessarily have to be for us, but there is like a human to human connection part of it that we seek. That's why we want it.
Sure.
There are other people who, not just for lack of talent, but for lack of desire, they're like, I have no interest in ever performing. I don't want to like resonate. Even like some people who, like, you know, I'm sure you have plenty of friends who are the most hilarious people or the best singers who would never get on a stage to sing, who would never do 5 minutes of stand-up. They have the talent, but there's no need for external validation, right? It seems like you are shifting into some sort of healthy zone where you have a relationship with your art, and that, you know, you are inherently making it for yourself, but you can still feel that pain when you upload it and the algorithm doesn't catch it and it doesn't take off or whatever. I've had a conversation with a couple people on the podcast so far that it's so silly to feel that in that moment when we get nothing. Like if we get nothing, That is not a product of our talent. I think it's very clear at this point that we have earned our stripes. We're good at what we do. Mm-hmm. And if it got into the right people's laps, it would be a deep cut. And the deep cuts are the ones that you like resonate with the most.
Right.
But because we are now in this algorithm-based networking era, where like we have to get it through the social media feeds before it gets into anybody's lap, sometimes the feeds just don't pick it up. And then we're left thinking, even though we know that it's because the algorithm didn't pick it up, we're left thinking it's because we suck.
Right.
Like, how do you get, and maybe you don't know, but how do we get out of that? Or how do we get back to some sort of like performing or writing things for us, or putting the blinders up to the world around you, and that it doesn't, that external validation doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't know. And that's one thing that I really struggled with doing this solo thing, is I can't, the whole social media thing is so toxic to people who are already prone to mental health issues, mm-hmm. or dealing with things, that, you know, searching for that instant gratification validation, and not getting it it sends you spiraling if you're not in the right headspace. And I can't do that. So I'm still playing the game, because I know it's a necessary evil in this day and age, in terms of self-promotion and building a brand and all of that. But I'm trying to approach it more in a way where it's just a necessary byproduct of what I have to do to get to where I want to be, not my sole or primary focus, I guess. So I'm trying to.
I've heard the phrase "play the game, don't look at the scoreboard."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would say that's an accurate way of putting it. In that, I'm just, you know, you're putting content out just so that there's content, because that's all anybody's looking at is, do they have content? How many followers do they have? You know, what's the engagement like? None of that means anything. You need to go out into the world and play. And getting back to talking about, you know, the financial component in terms of the solo thing, I play those shows down there not for any sort of financial reward. It's for the artistic and creative satisfaction of having an audience sitting and listening to what I'm doing, mm-hmm. and actively engaged in it. I mean, I've said this to the other artists I played with down at the Stray specifically, is that I do it because it's like a spiritual cleanse almost. It's like, this is why I do what I do. And I need to be reminded of that time and again, because, you know, when you're playing 3 hours to a room full of people who are actively ignoring you, that's soul crushing. Yeah. It's like, why am I even doing this? I might as well just go to an office and collect a paycheck, because it's effectively what I'm doing. And it's not satisfying in any way, shape, or form. So then to be able to do something like that, I mean, even if it's one or two people that are listening, they're listening, you know, that's all that matters to me. And like, what's been interesting is seeing the demographics and metrics from Spotify. And, you know, I have couple hundred listens on my songs. I don't, the mere fact though, that anybody is listening to them is mind blowing to me.
Oh dude.
And then to see
hundreds is nothing to scoff at.
Yeah. Like, well, there's the one song, the plus two, the version that we did the video for, and then the version I did at Dogtown Studios, this past summer, those have, you know, I think the studio version has over 500 listens, and then the Dogtown one has like 700 or 800 listens or something. And it's from people all over the world too.
Imagine when you see those numbers comparatively to, like, you see that video next to, like, you know, the latest Bad Baby video or something like that, that gets like 10 million views.
Right.
Then you get the like, oh, I suck, I'm no good. But if 500 to 800 people were in a room listening to you, that's an overwhelming amount.
It's incredible.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to be able to look at the map and see, you know, there's people in Scandinavia listening. There's people in Europe. There's people in South America listening. Like, how did you even come across this? Mm-hmm. It's just mind blowing. And just, you know, that I'm trying to just keep the focus on things like that, those little victories,
yeah,
where there are actual people listening, and people who give a shit, for lack of a better right. term, which is, I think that's all I'm really looking for anyway. It's we get so obsessed with the numbers game. It's like, let's focus on the quality over the quantity.
Yeah. And I think a level of relatability, just comparing it to this podcast in general, that it's a huge ask to get anybody to listen to something that is an hour to an hour and a half long right. on average. Right. That's a huge ask. That's sitting somebody to watch a movie with no expectation, especially if they've never seen me or anything I've done before. Just right. to ask some random person to do that. But if out of 100 people who come across the video, they get 30 seconds in, they're like, this isn't for me, and they scroll away, one of those people are likely to listen to the whole thing.
Right.
And that one person who finds some sort of connectivity, even though in the moment when I'm looking at the numbers, I don't feel that, really at the end of the day, we are playing to that one person. Mm-hmm. And we want that one person to be as engaged as possible, so that one person tells their other friend, and that's how it networks. But more so, it's less about, in theory, we want it to be less about how many people or whatever, but instead how deeply they relate to us. Because right. that's all we're really looking for, is to feel seen and heard.
Right. And that, you know? That basic connection. So I'd like to yeah. take this moment to thank that one person for listening.
Yeah. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Sincerely.
There is actually, I will say, there are actually a few people so far, which I am intimidated for giving them shout outs. At this point, I haven't given some friends shout outs in the podcast for listening. I just don't, for lack of exclude, I don't want to exclude anybody who doesn't.
Right.
I do have some loyal listeners.
Yes. Thank you, loyal listeners.
Yeah. Thank you. Like, it is, you know, it is very strange to know that at this point, we could say for you and for me, the next things we make, there are specifically people who will go out of their way to listen to it, no mm-hmm. matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it could be bad. This mm-hmm. next episode of my podcast, I'm not saying with you, because obviously this episode is phenomenal. And I'm not saying your next yet. Album, because clearly you're a creative individual. It's not for lack of, like, you know, we're not going to put out shit. But if we did, we have finally resonated with enough people, or people in particular, who would follow us anywhere.
Right.
And that is nothing, again, to scoff at. Like,
no.
Just to know that that we matter to anybody.
Right. And that's been the kind of the thing all along, especially with the solo stuff, is that, you know, I need to just keep in mind quality over quantity. Like, you don't mm-hmm. you don't want to see, you know, 1,000 people skipping through your song. You want to have right. those 4 or 5 people that are listening to the whole thing, listening to yep. it multiple times, engaging yep. with it, sharing with it, using it on playlists and things like that. Like, that's success to me, is resonating with somebody beyond my own brain who actually wants to listen to what I'm doing and what I'm creating. Like, that's insane to me that there's anybody who gives enough of a shit to listen to what I'm doing.
And beyond that, obviously we have, or it is healthy to have goals.
Sure.
But what is your, I don't know, it feels cliche to say, what's your 5-year plan?
Mm-hmm.
But what are some reasonable accomplishments that you can set for yourself, or achievements that you can set for yourself that you're looking forward to? Mm-hmm. Like, what are some milestones that you feel are achievable in the now?
Well, completing the album. And then getting that out. And then I'd like to do, you know, physical press. I'd like to do a vinyl release of it.
Cool.
And I'd like to, you know, be able to play some festivals and things like that. I think with the solo stuff, especially in the next few years, I want to move away from doing the 3-hour slogs. It's just not, it's not fun. It's not satisfying. I'd rather play 45 minutes, you know, 20 yeah. minutes, whatever, an opening slot for somebody, an opening slot for a national act. That'd be phenomenal. It's not fun to have to play for that long to no one listening, especially,
right. Not even just to no one listening, but to people actively ignoring.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's one thing if you're playing to the staff and the, you know, the establishment is largely empty and that's, yeah. you know, that's whatever. But if you're playing to a room full of people and they are actively ignoring you, it's just, yeah. that's as I said, that's just completely soul crushing. So at least when I'm playing with Rhett and that happens, we can play off of one another and right. have somebody to goof around with. But when it's just you, man, that makes for a very long night, and you question whether the money is even worth it at that point.
Money aside, this podcast, because it's my only level of relatability right now. I'm doing a lot of performing lately with the band that I'm in, but it's just to apples and oranges in the sense that, like, I don't even mean that genre wise they're different. It feels like drumming in a punk band is different than being a solo acoustic artist.
For sure.
Like they're different beasts entirely. And I'll be honest, like, music now at that point, especially as a drummer, there's no intimidation at all. Like, it is the one thing that I can confidently, yeah, toot my own horn or whatever. As like, I'm a good drummer, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to punk. It's my comfort zone. I don't really have to, like, I don't have to be front of stage. I like having a mic because I'm a narcissist and I'm an attention whore and I like talking about myself and I like talking. So give me a mic, obviously. But yeah, I don't feel any sort of intimidation up there. But when it comes to the podcast, I've done one solo episode, and the intention is, to make these an hour to an hour and a half every episode, give or take. I couldn't make it further than a half hour in the solo episode because I was just like, nobody wants to hear me talk about me. Like, I want to talk with other people. It is, yes, I can say that if I'm doing the episode, I'm just practicing and I'm doing it for myself to get better as an exercise. But ultimately, the reason that I'm doing this is to talk to people.
Right.
So, like, it almost took away from my original desire with this podcast to begin with. I think there's space for there to be solo episodes, but just having a conversation with someone gives me that immediate validation when I feel seen in the moment or whatever, rather than waiting for an audience to tune in.
Right. But I mean, I think if we're going to use the analogy of you being a punk drummer, being comfortable doing that, I mean, you didn't start out immediately feeling comfortable on stage as a drummer, did you?
You know what? I think I did.
Did you?
It's very strange.
Well, did you, and was it because of all the time you spent practicing beforehand, or did you just inherently feel comfortable and confident on stage and it was a medium in which you felt confident and adept?
I think that you are giving me great fodder for a future episode because ADHD Deep Dive exclusive, heyo, breaking news, this has not been actually announced yet. One of my next guests is going to be my music instructor from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I think the confidence is 100% in his, like, I owe that to him.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, I was almost never intimidated as a drummer because he was so validating as a teacher, and he just kind of instilled the confidence in me that I needed from day one.
Mm-hmm.
So I have him to thank for that. But yeah, if I'm playing guitar, if I'm singing, even though I feel that confidence, there's intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
But drumming, I've just never felt nervous about. Mm-hmm. I've always felt like that was the thing I was meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I was able to quit in a band. Like, I quit for 10, I quit playing drums for 10 years,
yeah.
quit performing live for 10 years, picked up a drum set, and I feel better than I ever was. It's like, it has so deeply been a part of me that the first time I ever performed, I performed with like my orchestra band,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, let's say 40 people. Then the next time I performed was with my jazz band class, which was 10 people. Then the next time I performed was with my real band, which was like 5 people. So it was never just about me.
Right.
So I never felt that intimidation.
Right.
But as a solo person, like, when it's all about me, oh God,
yeah.
I feel sick.
Well, I think that
I want it.
Right. Exactly. I think that, yeah. that kind of goes back to what I was saying about, you know, having played in bands and then going down to a duo and then going down to a solo thing. You just, over time, you build that confidence and comfort
yeah.
in what you're doing. And you know, it's, you're still very early on in your podcasting career. You'll get to
yeah, a point this is later. This is episode 9 or 10, one of the two. We're still,
yeah, you have 9,991 more to go to get your 10,000 hours in.
That's right, yeah, that's right. The 10,000 isn't that what it is? Like, you have to do something for 10,000 hours
before you're proficient.
Well, dear God, let's hope that doesn't happen. But I do think about it, like, the fact this is a very attainable goal is uploading one podcast a week on a Monday. Just having a conversation and then documenting it. Yes, there's a little bit of an editing process, but it's really not that over-encumbering. Like, it's not that difficult to do. And when you think about it, if I've been doing it for, I'm on episode 9 or 10 or whatever. If I've been doing it for a year, that will only be 52 episodes.
Right.
So, like, it doesn't seem like a lot, but that means I've been doing something for a year.
Right. And it keeps you honest and working towards something as well.
Yes.
With those self-imposed deadlines.
Yes. And because it's so staggered that it is only 1 week, there is clear room for progress every week. It could get better every week because I'm listening to the podcast back to hear how I interrupted people or how many times I projected or how many times, you know, you analyze yourself. And you only, yes, there is some unhealthy side to that, but like it will only get better for me and the listener from here on out.
Right.
And that's cool to know.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, I'm kicking you off.
All right.
You get off my podcast.
All right.
I'm just kidding. I think that this is probably an appropriate time to do those plugs. Sure. You, in no particular order, I know we've discussed the projects that you are a part of, but I'll do the hot ones thing. This camera, this camera, this camera. Tell the people what you got going on in your life.
Well, right now everything's kind of slowing down a bit.
Yeah. Great timing.
Seasonally. Working on the album, that's kind of the biggest thing right now. That'll be hopefully done first part of next year and then hopefully out in the spring or so. And then just
any details on names or
for the record? Yeah, it's going to be called The Road to Life, which is going to be the last track on the album.
Okay.
And that I did that song at Dogtown Studios this last summer, which you can find on all streaming services and on my Instagram page. I need to be better about updating my YouTube page and website. I've kind of neglected both of those in favor of the instant gratification of Instagram. And the
Have you heard of this cool social media site called Twitter? I hear it's popping right now. You should consider getting into that. Because I hear there's a huge future in that.
Yes. No Twitter. No Twitter for me. No Twitter for me.
That's probably for the best.
No TikTok either. I'm too old.
Yeah.
For that stuff. I can't. It's just...
So far, that's the majority opinion of the guests on my podcast. But listeners so far have been telling me that I'm just dead wrong on TikTok.
Yeah. I have friends who keep saying, no, everybody does TikTok. Well...
That's why I don't want to do it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't do what everybody does.
Yeah.
I was working remotely 2 years before the entire world was working remotely. So.
Okay, so we've got John Richard Paul, Instagram, your YouTubes, you're a part of.
Which you can find the video we shot together.
Yes, and I'll put some links in the description as well to these particular projects. This will probably be out, let's see, what is next Monday? What is next week Monday? What is that date?
Next week Monday is right in front of me. Let me bring it up real quick.
Every device that has a calendar is
the 5th,
currently recording something.
The fifth of December. Yes.
So around that time, do you have any dates coming up for shows that you'd like to announce or?
I'll be playing solo at Acoustic Tap Room in Traverse City. Let's see, what is the date on that one? Sorry, I gotta bring that.
I put you on the spot.
The 17th of December. That'll be my last solo show of the year. Lots of dates still with Rhett and John this year. Those can all be found at rhettandjohn.com. We play all over Northern Michigan. I'll be playing with Drew Hale again in the new year. You can find dates on his site. I think it's Drew Hale Music. Or Drew Hale Live, one of those two. Apologies, Drew, if you're listening. But just do additional bass things here and there. I play in the NMC big band, which is the college big band. I play bass for that.
I didn't know that.
I started doing that. It's a class, but I did that. I started doing that a year and a half ago. The current director is my former saxophone teacher. So I keep reminding her that she was my teacher 25 years ago and that she's been teaching longer than I've been alive. just to make myself feel better about the fact that I'm now 41.
I was going to say, all that aging that we did of ourselves earlier, right, we just stepped up one generation.
Yeah, so that, and then I play in a group called East Bay Drive in town. I play bass for that as well. It's kind of a jazz project. And then got some other things coming up with folks in the area. You know, just trying to diversify as much as possible to keep it interesting and keep it, you know, financially viable and make this a full-time, continue to make this a full-time venture.
Lean into pop punk and maybe we'll pick you up for a show.
Sounds good. I'll go back
I'm sure we'll need some bass.
I'll go back to my emo roots.
And that's right. Into that. It never dies, bro. It never dies.
Never dies.
As much as we'd like to, brother. Okay, go ahead and hang out on the line so we can have a proper goodbye. But for the sake of the podcast, thank you for joining.
Appreciate you.
And peace, fam. I still can't end these things properly.
No, don't do that.